Have you listened to the first episode of this two-part interview with Minda Zetlin, author of Career Self-Care? If not, please go back and check it out. We're picking up right where we left off, so stick around.
You know, when I was your age, go ask your mother. I know you don't like it. It builds character. How many times do I have to tell you? I'm not just talking to hear my own voice.
Hello, listener, and welcome to Dadages. I'm your host, Chad Hagel. And if you are looking for some fatherly wisdom for your career, your family, or any other aspect of your life, then you've come to the right place. If you want to learn more about Dadages, find additional content, submit questions, or feedback to me, visit dadages.com. Thanks for being here. And before you listen to our podcast, please listen to your father. Well, Dadages friends and family, we are back. I'm pleased to continue our wonderful interview with the lovely and insightful Minda Zetlin. In episode one of this interview, we had a lively debate on company culture and work environment. And today we're picking up with the question I posed to Minda at the end of the first episode. Let's get back to it. I want to shift the focus now to community, because I loved what you talked about. And this is actually in chapter five of your book. You said, if you follow only one piece of advice in this book, so my ears perked up when I heard that, please let it be this. You need community to support you in both your career and your life. You go on to say that this need for community is literally encoded into our DNA. Can you explain more about your research and your thoughts on these important topics?
Okay, so it's not my research so much as me curating other people's research. The probably most famous high-profile version of this is the Blue Zones research that shows that the people who, so I mean, there's been a lot of debate over the Blue Zones that we don't need to go into, but Dan Buettner, I'm never sure I'm saying his name right. Anyway, researcher went and explored the places in the world, the communities in the world where people had the greatest longevity and tried to figure out why. And they had a variety of healthy habits in common, but what they also had in common was very, very tight-knit communities. One of the most fascinating ones was Okinawa, where people from a young age form something called a moai, where it's a group for mutual benefit. And if one person gets a windfall, they all share. If one person has an unexpected financial pressure, they all contribute. So it's truly sort of like a community safety net. And these kinds of things, yes, are encoded into human evolution. We have always lived in tribes and clans and communities, and we always seek to create communities. And, you know, we see it in almost everything we do. I mean, we sports clubs, Swifties, fans of whatever. Also, if you have a problem, what's the first thing you do? You find a support group. There's always, we're hardwired to seek community. And increasingly in the modern world, sometimes either we don't, or the community we have, and I don't mean to disparage social media, but the community we have is a social media community that doesn't feel as nourishing. Well, there might or might not be, you know, I mean, a lot of people might like or, you know, print, oh, I'm so sorry or whatever, but it's not. And I'm not saying that people have to be physically together, although being physically together is very helpful. People don't have to be physically together to be a community, but I think there needs to be a sort of more direct and personal interaction than, you know, someone commenting on a social media post, if I could put it that way. We need that. And in some ways in the modern world, it's gone by the wayside. And, you know, one of the greatest predictors of longevity or not is whether you live by yourself or not. It's a really sad, simple thing. So I know in my own career, having community has been extraordinarily helpful, both in terms of learning and in terms of not feeling alone and in terms of just having people to sort of have your back. And I think that that's really important for every career.
For sure, for career and for life.
And for life, yeah, yes.
And, you know, one of the reasons that I really love this part of your book is that you do make it quite personal and you kind of go back to your own origin story. And we love that kind of stuff here at Dadages, understanding how our upbringing and the roles of our parents and other mentors really shape our lives and our perspectives. You shared that both of your parents were immigrants. You talked about the isolation that existed in your household growing up in Manhattan and some of those impacts upon your perspective and your life. Can you share a little bit more about how these formative experiences in your life have shaped your perspectives on community and how it's essential to humankind?
Well, so I was an only child of immigrants. My father was such a workaholic that he actually tried to work on his deathbed. He was a psychiatrist and he had patients who were very, very emotionally dependent on him and who he had been seeing for a long time. And when he was literally in the hospital at the end of his life, some of them wanted to come see him, you know, not to visit him, but to have a session. And he wanted to do it. And, you know, fortunately, the hospital said, you know, you're out of your mind. We're not doing this. But he was that much of a workaholic. My mother, when I was growing up, was involved in theater. She had been an actor in the Philippines, and she was an actor and worked in as an assistant producer when I was growing up. So between the two of them, they were often not around. So I spent quite a lot of time by myself when I was growing up. I guess that's a, you know, not uncommon only child thing. As I got older and got, you know, as we do, we grow up and go out into the world, I discovered how powerful a thing community can be. When I left, so I said that I've been a solopreneur for most of my career. When I left the job that I had and struck out as a freelance writer, I went to the community of self-employed writers that I knew and, you know, plumbed the depths of their knowledge to kind of get me started. And that's where I discovered ASJA. I commonly say I'm sure I would have had some sort of career without ASJA, but I don't know what it would have been because almost everything has some connection to ASJA, including working for Inc., so including the agent who sold this book. So community is an extraordinarily powerful thing for both your job, but also your life.
I love that story, by the way. I love the initiative that you shared in that moment in your life when you really reached out and had the drive, work to build this community and to find that community for yourself, where a lot of people would look at that situation and just not even know where to start. And it's one of those kind of things, where the place to start is the beginning. You just start and you find a way to get there. And in my experience has been so parallel in that regard. One of the things that I've done in my life, and this was 15, 16 years ago now, was to form an organization where one didn't exist. And that was Stanford Professionals in Real Estate, Spire. And just as you described, I can't point to anything in the last half decade at least of my life, in my career and in my personal life, that doesn't have some thread that weaves back to that organization. And I find that community is one of those things that the more you put into the community, the more you get back to it in multiples. It really does pay off. And those of us that are willing to take on a leadership role, because you went on to become president of ASJA at one point, right?
Yep, I was president for 2 years, which is kind of the standard time to be president there. And I was on the board of ASJA many, many, many years. It's embarrassing to even say how many. So I feel like that organization had my fingerprints all over it. But I do like to say, when you've got a problem to solve, don't just think how, also think who.
Oh, that's great. I love that. And going back to this leadership role that you're talking about, I'm imagining you experienced the same thing that I did, which is when you get to that level and you're really, really putting in the time and the effort and the energy, you may think it's a real drain on your life and on what time you should be devoting to your job, but that's when things really get supercharged. That's when stepping up and taking a focal role in an organization like that can establish you as a community leader, as a thought leader, and can, from that moment on, really have a massive impact on your career and your trajectory. Did you find that in your experience as well?
You know, I did, actually. Yeah, it sort of gave me visibility. It gave me a lot of confidence. It gave me, as someone who had, you know, only ever been briefly an employee and then a self-employed person, it gave me some ideas about leadership. It also taught me where my big weaknesses are as a leader, which was a great lesson to learn. I'm not running an organization or looking to run an organization now, but at least if it ever comes up again, I know what my blind spots are a lot better than I did when I did that. And yeah, it does. It's true. I mean, there was a definite, just even income wise, there was certainly a big uptick in my income after I did that 2 years of volunteer work, which I thought was really interesting. I'm not 100% sure I can explain it or point it back to that. But one thing that did happen is I mentioned that I'm doing more and more public speaking now. And when it comes to writing, I'm very experienced when it comes to public speaking. I think I'm pretty experienced as a speaker, but I'm not really experienced at the business of running a speaking business. And so I joined the National Speakers Association local chapter here in the Seattle area where I am. And no sooner had I joined, but I went for coffee with one of the board members, and I told her that I had been on the board of ASJA for 16 years, and she said, oh, you must be on our board. So now I'm, having just joined, I'm now on
the
board.
You're on your way up again.
Right, maybe.
So what, you're going to be president of that association in how many years then?
I don't know. It depends on whether it depends on board experience or speaker experience, I think.
Well, I loved what you shared about how a leadership experience can really crystallize in your mind where your weaknesses are and give you that visibility. And I love that you were talking about blind spots, because actually, our very next guest on Datages is the author of Blind Spots, Marissa Murray. This is a spoiler alert and a bit of a preview for the Datages friends and family to come back and check that out, because she talks all about that, the importance of leaders being able to identify where there are weaknesses, either in their own skill set or things that they haven't yet learned, opportunities for growth, or within their organizations. And I think that whenever you take on a leadership role, it's so important to look in the mirror and look for those things. So I appreciate you sharing all of that perspective about leadership. And I want to talk about leadership of a different type. You in the book go on to provide a lot of tangible, actionable advice and guidance as to how you can make your professional life more rewarding and positive. And in particular, there's a whole section on mentorship and sponsorship. And you make it clear that those are related but different things in the work environment. What exactly is the difference between a mentor and a sponsor, and why does somebody need both?
So a mentor, I think mentor is a more common and familiar term. And I also think that I say in the book that, you know, I had this image in my mind of what a mentor would be. For those of you who are, you know, as old as me, I referenced Lou Grant from the old Mary Tyler Moore show. But, there's a lot of, in popular culture and elsewhere, there's a lot of examples of mentors. And I have never had a mentor. I've been mentored by a lot of people. So a mentor is someone who can in different ways guide you, advise you, give you the lay of the land. If you're inside an organization, sort of give you a view into the politics happening there, which might not always be obvious, why you should, you know, be careful to do this or to favorably impress that person or something. Things like that. A mentor can also help you see your own blind spots and where you might need to do better or learn a bit more. And a mentor is invaluable for all that stuff. And it's great also to be a mentor. Research shows that mentoring not only benefits the career of the person receiving it, but also the career of the person doing it, especially in, of course, in organizations that have formal mentoring programs, but even when they don't. So mentoring is fantastic and we all need it. And some would argue we all need multiple mentors because nobody has all the answers to everything we need to know. So within our careers and then also sometimes within our lives, we all need mentors. A sponsor is something else. A sponsor is somebody who will actually advocate for you. So a mentor, you might ask someone to be your mentor or mentors is kind of a big word and people don't necessarily know what they're signing up for if they agree. So sometimes it's better to say, hey, could you give me a little bit of advice about this? Or could you have coffee with me? I'm hoping to learn more about X. And I think.
And is that the distinction you made in the book between a formal versus informal mentor that you're describing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The formal mentor thing is, if there's a mentoring program in your organization, then it's pretty straightforward. But if there isn't, to say to somebody, you know, hey, would you be my mentor could be a bit intimidating for them. So you need to approach it with some sensitivity to that. And maybe, a lot of people get mentoring and a lot of people are mentors without ever actually using the M word. However, a sponsor is, you can't ask someone to be your sponsor because someone becomes your sponsor because of how impressed with you they are. So a sponsor is somebody who is in executive position or perhaps if you're an entrepreneur, perhaps a high up position within a customer organization or something, who is very impressed with you. And when projects come up or when opportunities come up that might be good for you, they will say, hey, Chad would be really great for this. Or, we should give this to Chad because the last thing he did for us, the last thing he did for us went really, really well. Why don't you consider him? You can't ask someone to do that. You have to show them why they should do that. But having sponsors is an incredibly powerful thing for all of us. The sponsors that I've had in my career have definitely made a gigantic difference to my success. And if you are in a large organization, so I'm told by people who do this, because once again, I'm not, but if you're in a large organization and you aspire to reach a vice president level or another upper management level, you absolutely cannot do it without sponsors.
I can only imagine. I have not been in a large organization like that either, but I've worked in a volunteer capacity within large institutions like Stanford University, and I couldn't imagine anyone navigating their way up through that infrastructure and that bureaucracy without having somebody pulling them up from the top. So it's a great differentiation. I appreciate you sharing that. And I was going to say, until you explained it more fully, I've had mentors. I've had great mentors. I have had a formal mentor who's still my mentor today, Gary Rappaport, who is a very established executive and owner of a large real estate organization. And then I was going to say, I haven't had a sponsor. But then you characterized it a little bit further, and I realized that I actually have, because I talk about how in my business, everything in the business is based upon two things, relationships and performance. And the first of those is actually the more important of the two. I've definitely had people, and this happens all the time in the real estate industry, where somebody moves from one company to another, and I follow the relationship, not necessarily the company. And I've had that advocate at a different retailer, for example, who would come to me and say, hey, I worked with you when you were doing this for this other company. I'd like you to do that for my new company too. So I think that if we look hard, we can find those opportunities both for mentorship and for sponsorship, even those of us that are entrepreneurs, and they can be extremely valuable. So I hope everyone listens acutely and takes that advice, because I think it is so important.
No, I was just going to say, and remember, you cannot ask someone to be your sponsor, but you can say something like, you know, hey, I'm looking for more opportunities in case there's anything that you think I might be a good fit for.
That's a very good strategic way to put it, for sure. You have to, it's one of those things you never know until you ask, but you have to find exactly the right way to ask. So I appreciate that additional advice. And speaking of providing advice and guidance, you know, I'd like to talk a little bit more now about taking this out of a professional context, because so many of the things that you've studied and so many things that you've communicated about mean so much in a family situation as well, and how we share it with people in the next generation. You've obviously both spent a lot of your time and effort and energy communicating to the rest of the world about the wisdom that you have captured. And then you also have shared with me how you have evolved into a beautiful family structure where your role is so important to the family as well. Let's talk first about the professional setting. As an author, can you talk about what motivates you every time you sit down at your computer to write and to be able to share what's inside your mind and share your experience with others?
Oh, I hate thinking that I'm like trying to make the world a better place, because that makes me sound, you know, more highfalutin than I think I really am. But I think a lot of people, I think for most people, writing is about sharing what you've found, what you've learned, what's in your heart, what's worked for you. Every single thing that's in my book is something that I myself have tried. The book is full of exercises and, yeah, advice. And everything in my book is stuff I've tried. So this all grew out of me writing the column for over a decade. And during that time, I read I don't know how many studies and talked to I don't know how many experts about different ways to do the work-life balance that you think is not a good term. And people do have other, many people don't like the term and they come up with other ways of saying it. But all the stuff in that book I've tried. And most of the stuff that I wrote about, I also tried. And, you know, I figured out what works for me, what seems to work for people, what the brain science says people should do. And yeah, I just love sharing that, you know, with everyone. And I think that for, you know, especially for the professional people who tend to be really work driven, who tend to struggle with work-life balance, and who, you know, unfortunately or fortunately are privileged enough to have some choices about how they spend their time, it's really important to use those choices and use that privilege wisely. And so I love sharing the insights that I've picked up over the years. I love sharing a good story too. I love writing stuff that I think people will like. And part of this came about because when you write for the internet, as you I'm sure know, you get very immediate feedback as to what people are interested in and not interested in. And I got very immediate feedback that people were really interested in learning how to be more productive and have better work-life balance and be more mindful. There's a chapter on mindfulness and a lot of things that to me, I phrase as looking at the big picture of your career and your work and your job and your life. And so I really enjoy sharing that stuff. And so it's as much as anything, me just doing what I enjoy.
That's fantastic to hear. And I don't think that any of that, And thank you for sharing it first and foremost. And I don't think that any of that makes you sound self-important. I think it makes you sound mission-driven. And I have a ton of respect for that. And, you know, you talk about getting that instant feedback. When you're writing a book, you can't be sitting there with the person who's reading it to see the impact that you're having on them the way you might in a company setting or in a mentor-mentee setting where you're directly engaging with somebody. So I hope that you have the sense and let me express directly that your work definitely has a positive impact. There's a lot that I read that I have internalized and that will rest in my mind and weigh in on decisions that I make both for myself and for my company, as I shared. So I think it's fantastic to have that perspective. I'm glad you enjoy it so much. That's great to hear. And I'm also glad to know that you're so motivated to share, as you said, both stories and knowledge with people because there's value in both.
Well, thank you so much. I had a secret little advantage too, as far as that goes, while I was writing the book, which isn't so secret. It's actually available to any of your listeners in the United States. I have, through Inc., I have a program where I send out, it's also called Career Self-Care, where people sign up and they get a text from me Monday to Friday. And it's $4.95 a month, but depending on how you sign up, you can get a couple months for free. Anyhow, so a lot of the things, so I started doing that right around the time I started writing the book, and it was so helpful because a lot of the texts were the same concepts that went into the book, and people would text me back and say, oh, thank you, that was so helpful. And I thought, okay, that worked. So it gave me the confidence that all this stuff that was coming out of my brain, you know, that made sense to me, but I wasn't sure that it would have an impact on someone else. That gave me the confidence to know that, yeah, this does make sense when people read it. So that was shout out to my texties out there.
To the texties. Yeah, that's great. You have your own new tribe, your own new moai of the texties. Absolutely. That's great. And speaking of your tribe, as I was mentioning a moment ago, you as a stepmother, as a step-grandmother, have evolved into a very important role as the head of a large family now with multi-generational impact on that family. Can you help us understand, for those of us that are parents or step-parents that are involved in a family setting, how you're able to package up some of this great wisdom and the insights that you are most often sharing in a professional setting, and how you apply that and how you communicate that effectively within your family setting?
I am, as Chad and I discussed before we came live here, I'm not a parent. I am, however, the stepmother of two and the step-grandmother of four. And it's been a really interesting role to me. So when my husband and I got married, or at least when we got together, because we were together for a few years before he got married, his kids were 20 and 21. And so I came into their lives at a somewhat formative stage. Interestingly, they were roughly the same ages when I married, or at least when I got together with their father, as I was when my parents, who had been separated and then divorced for many years, each also remarried. I also got a stepmother and a stepfather when I was in my 20s. So that was a really interesting sort of circularity. And my stepfather in particular was a very big part of my life. Maybe as much, certainly from that point on, probably as much or more than my actual father. So step-parenting can be an important thing even to children who are just entering adulthood. So yeah, I think just because of who I am and kind of where I am in life, I feel like a lot of times my role is to try to broaden horizons. I mean, sometimes sort of literally, because as I mentioned, I am the child of immigrants. So at this time, I actually don't have any blood relations that I know of in the United States. They're all elsewhere. And I have a lot of family in France. And my husband actually also has family in Ireland. We went and connected with them on one trip. So part of that has been, hey, you know, there's a great big world out there. Let us show you these family members you have who are not even, you know, part of the reality that you're currently living in. So that has been a big piece of it. I've been super fortunate, as not everyone in my husband's family has been, to figure out what I wanted to do, what I enjoyed doing, what felt meaningful to me, and actually make a living at it. Now, could I have made a better living if I had decided to become a lawyer or an investment banker? Absolutely. But I love this work. And
you may have made a better income, maybe not a better living.
Yes. And thank you for that distinction. Exactly.
Of course.
So when I see young people, not just actually even are my husband's grandchildren, but any young people or career people trying to think about what they want to do in life, you know, I understand the need to be realistic, but I also want to encourage people to at least try to pursue something that would really make them happy, because the percentage of our life that we spend working is really too great to have it just be about, oh, I need this income. It could just be about money if money is what makes you happy, right? Like, so, you know, Warren Buffett, I mean, I think money makes him happy. Okay. But it has to really be something that feeds your soul, I think, if possible.
Absolutely. It's a great message. And do you find that that message takes root with the next generation and the generation after that? Is it getting across? And do you see them living that out the way you would hope for them?
Being 1000% honest, not entirely yet, but it's early days.
There's time.
As far as my own family is concerned, I think actually, yeah, I guess I'm, you know, I'm thinking about the youngest generation. I think both of my husband's children have, with a fair amount of trial and error, found their ways to work that they love. It does sometimes, it takes a few tries. I mean, I kind of came out of the egg knowing I wanted to be a writer, but I think that's an exception. I think a lot of people need to try different things. And I think it's great to try different things.
For sure, for sure. And one of the things my therapist used to say to me is, Chad, you can do everything you want in your life, just not all right now. And that was advice I needed to hear, and advice that I've put to work for the rest of my life, is learning that I can save something for later. There are things that I can do that I don't have. It, again, comes back to capability and capacity. I may not have right. the capacity to do it right now. That doesn't mean I don't have the capability to do it at some point. So I think that's very valuable advice. I'm really happy to hear you share it, and I'm happy to hear that it's resonating with the next generation. I hope it resonates with our Dadage's friends and family as well, because it's such an important message. Well, Minda, this has been a lot of fun. And speaking of fun, before we get going, one of the things that we do like to celebrate here at Dadage's is the notion of the bad dad joke or the bad parent joke, because we believe that humor makes the world go round. I'm wondering if you have one that you would like to share with the Dadage's friends and family today.
Oh, well, this may be one that people have heard, but what did the Dalai Lama say to the hot dog vendor?
I don't know. What'd he say?
Make me one with everything.
Ah, I love that. I love that. That's actually a great one. And you know, I was trying to find a joke about the workplace, but I couldn't find a good one. I do have a lot of jokes about unemployed people, but none of them work.
Oh, yeah, there you go. But that Dalai Lama joke. So what I really loved about that is, so, okay, so that's easy and straightforward. And I love it too, because I think mindfulness and meditation and all that stuff is, I don't like necessarily talking to people too much about meditation, because for many people, that's a very scary word. Mm-hmm. But I do think that that can be a very big part of having a more balanced life and even a more fruitful career. A lot of entrepreneurs I know actually make the time to meditate, because it just helps you think clearly about everything that's going on. But one of my favorite things, and you can go find this on YouTube if you want to, is that there was a reporter, and I wish I could remember what the station was or what the town is, but I can't, who actually tried to tell this joke to the Dalai Lama.
Really?
See, the Dalai Lama came to his town, and he said it, and he introduced it by saying, you know, I knew this was a bad idea, and I did it anyway. And then there's the video of him, I think he told it with pizza. So he said, what does a Dalai Lama say in the pizzeria? So I'm not sure that Dalai Lama even knew what pizza was. And I think they're supposed to be vegan. So I don't think he could even eat pizza.
So I imagine it was very awkward crickets.
It was very awkward crickets. But the thing is, the Dalai Lama is so good natured and so benevolent that he was really trying hard to understand and you know, get the point of this joke. And just, it was just, you know, so bad. It was funny, hilariously funny.
He was trying to be one with the joke and struggle to get there, it sounds just, like.
It didn't work at all.
Yeah, I don't think that's a good recipe for a stand-up comedian, for sure.
No.
I love the story, and thanks for sharing that, you know, anecdotes about mindfulness. As an 18-year devotee to yoga and spending a lot of time and focus on that, I recognize the importance of that and creating that balance that you're talking about and the mindfulness that can help us be more productive in all phases of life. So I think it's a really good sort of spiritual take on everything that you shared with us today and everything that you shared in the book. And before we take off, maybe you can just share with the Dadage's friends and family, you mentioned earlier a couple of ways that they can find you and engage with you. Maybe you can share those again. Anyone who wants more and more and everything Minda Zetlin, where can they go?
Oh, all kinds of places, but start at mindazetlin.com. That has, so that'll take you to a homepage about speaking. But if you look around, there's contact information, there's social media. So X, formerly Twitter, now X, and LinkedIn are the social media where I'm most active, especially LinkedIn. If you use LinkedIn, as I'm hoping a lot of your listeners do because they might be entrepreneurs, come find me there. But, you know, you can also find me on Facebook. You can find me everywhere. I'm just saying this is where I'm most active. Then find me at Inc. You know, if you go on Inc.com, you're liable to find me. If you search Minda Zetlin at Inc., you'll find everything I've ever written there. Many of my pieces also have a link to a fuller explanation and a way to sign up for the text if you're interested in trying them for free. But yeah, reach out, come find me. And of course, the book is on Amazon and any place that you might buy a book, as well as findable through my website.
Wonderful. And I enjoyed it on Audible as well.
Yes, I'm so glad about that. I wanted to tell you, that is a friend of mine.
Oh, really?
Who read it on Audible.
Brilliantly read. Yeah, very well read.
Yeah, she's one of my oldest and dearest friends. And she was starting out, she's a cabaret singer, and she's, I think, a lovely voice. And she had set up a book narrator studio in her apartment and was starting to work as book narrator when I was working on the book. And she said, is there going to be an audiobook of your book? And if so, you know, would you... Could I do it? So I said, well, you know, I don't know, but I'll put your name out there. And, you know, because she was very qualified to do it, not just because I suggested her, yeah. She wound up doing it. So now I hear the audiobook in my dear friend's voice, and it's so wonderful.
That's amazing. I can imagine that conversation. Can I read your book? Of course. No, I mean, can I read your book?
Yes,
that's
exactly.
Great. That's great. I'm really happy to hear that you're, you know, sharing those opportunities with your friends and family. And thank you so much again for being here with our friends and family at Dadages. This has been a great hour or so spent talking with you, and I'm taking a lot away from it. I know everyone else will as well. So thank you.
Well, thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure.
And until next time, I'll remind the Dadages friends and family, Dad may not always know what he's talking about, but he sure can sound like he does.